Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, everyone. This is Annabelle and Emily coming to you direct from the perineum of the year.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
We don't know what day it is. We don't know what to eat next, but I'm sure we'll be eating something imminently.
Imminently. In the meantime, we are just popping up to share with you one of our most popular episodes of 2023, which is called How to Be Happier.
Now, there's a surprise. It seemed an appropriate time to leave it here for anyone who needs it. Happy New Year. See you on the other side. Happiness. Speaking of happiness, today we have someone here who actually teaches happiness. I mean, how exciting is that? At UCLA, of all places, to people who are doing MBAs. Professor Cassie Holmes, she's actually a professor. Professor Cassie Holmes is an award-winning academic and social psychologist who, nearly defeated by the grind, decided to learn how to have a happier, more fulfilling existence. And, happily, she's written a book about it called Happier Hour, full of practical tips and wisdom to help everyone find their happy hour. But before she gives us her masterclass, Cassie, how are you?
I am absolutely fine. But I am scared to shake people's hands and I will not pick up a pot because I injured my wrist 4 months ago and I haven't had time to go to the doctor. So I don't have time to take care of myself, but we'll be talking about spending time on things that really matter. And apparently my own wrist is not something that matters. Meanwhile, I'm happy to spend time on coffee dates, on having a glass of wine and all of that stuff. And actually I've taken my children to the doctor many times in the last 3 months for various things, but yet I have not taken myself to the doctor. But
just wait till your wrist hurts so much that you can't actually lift your glass of wine, and then maybe you'll be like, okay, right?
That will be the thing that sends me to the doctor.
That'll be the pinch point, because your book is, you know, ostensibly about happiness, but really it's very much about time, isn't it? And about
absolutely
taking control of your time. And it's almost like a cookery book, and the ingredients are, you know, sections and dollops and fragments of time. And how did you come up with this sort of formula around happiness?
Yeah, and it really started from a dark place of me being quite unhappy because of feeling a lack of time. And so when I was earlier in my career, I was an assistant professor at Wharton, and it was just one of these crazy days that I'm sure so many can relate to of between work. So I had gone up to New York that morning to give a talk, and then it was like rushing between meetings, and then I caught the very last train that would get me home to my four-month-old and my husband asleep in Philly. And I just remember as I was like sitting on the train and looking out the window as the darkness was rushing by and the little houses where people were sleeping and I felt like I should be sleeping too, I was like, I don't know if I can keep up, right? Between the pressures of work, wanting to be a good partner, wanting to be a good parent, wanting to be a good friend, the never-ending pile of chores, there simply were not enough hours in the day to get it all done, let alone to do any of it well, let alone to enjoy any of it along the way. And I was like, I don't think I can do this. And so I actually very much was considering, like, I don't think I can do this. So maybe the answer is quitting. Maybe I quit this job that I had worked so hard for. I mean, I like got my PhD. I got this like dream job at the top business school in the States. And I'm like, I don't think I can do it. And so it was really that time as a limitation that was making me question my whole existence. And I did not quit because I am still a professor, just at a different business school. But I realized I needed to change something. And the change, since I am a researcher, a social psychologist, a lot of the questions that I'm grappling or was grappling with, and actually continue to in some cases, are testable. And I could look and study them to find what are answers so that it's not just asking an opinion of one person, you know, what do I do? Or like me in my lowest state of like, you know, what do I think I can do? It's actually looking to data to look at patterns to drive some advice. And so I've been conducting the research for the last 15 years, applying it to my life. And while I am not spending the time to take myself to the doctor, I will say that I am happy. I'm no longer in that sort of distressed, like, shit, I can't do any of it stage. Like, yes, I have a lot of unanswered emails. Yes, there's a lot of people that are probably annoyed with me because I'm not doing what they've asked me to do. But I am spending on the things that matter.
I mean, when we think about happiness, I think a lot of people think that's chasing something ridiculous. It's sort of dancing and juggling with sunbeams. But happiness isn't really about, you know, extreme joy, is it? It's more about, from your point of view, just feeling reasonably positive during your days and satisfied with the way your life is running.
Exactly. And so when I use the term happiness, and it does have that connotation, and I suspect there's even some cultural differences in the States versus the UK, where maybe even in the UK, it's like, oh my gosh, that sort of silly thing that folks are striving for. But that's not what I mean. What I'm talking about is what we refer to in the psychology literature as subjective well-being. So it's our well-being, and the subjectivity is like, it's based off of how we personally feel. So feeling more positive than negative in your day-to-day, so during your experiences, as well as an overall sort of evaluation of your life as satisfying, as fulfilling, as meaningful. And those feeling positive inner experiences are very closely related and a sort of predictor of feeling satisfied about our experiences. There are cases where you can sort of disentangle the two. But really what I want and the advice that I give based off of the research is towards satisfaction. It's about contentment in our days so that, you know, to your question, how are you doing? It's like, I'm absolutely fine. And like, you want to feel like you are sort of fine. And then there's, of course, buts. And it's those buts that I'm really looking to help people address so that maybe there wouldn't even be a but. It's like, I'm actually fine.
What I find really accessible and helpful about your book is it deals with the small things. So it deals with the sort of Lego bricks, the building blocks of your day. If you could just take those apart and look at those, then the result might be quite a lot bigger and more substantial than the sum of the parts, is the way that it feels anyway.
Absolutely. And I actually think that it's those little bits that are sort of the secret to our overall satisfaction and our happiness in life. And it's those little bits that we are often distracted from, that like they are there in our days, but we might not even notice them, or we're on our phones of like not even paying attention to them as they're happening. And that's natural. There's actually a psychological tendency that we have to adapt. So hedonic adaptation is our tendency to get used to things over time. So when we do the same thing again and again, when we're with the same person or people again and again, it stops having the same intense emotional impact. And it's really good that we're adaptive in the face of bad stuff because it makes us resilient, you know, and tolerant. But the problem is that we also adapt to those good things such that we don't notice them. And so as I shared this example or this story in the book of me walking my son to preschool one day, and it was such a perfect moment. Like objectively, it was shiny and joyous and like birds singing in the trees, the sun shining, And it was something that I had worked really hard to sort of set up this perfect experience, because I had gotten a job so I could move back to Southern California, where there would be sun shining, where I was living next to beautiful UCLA campus and could walk my son to preschool on campus, me to my office. All of this was hard to construct. And my husband was having had a job in the same place, finally, that we were both sort of happy. But it was this random morning where it was such perfection. And my son, he was 3 at the time, he was sort of skipping along beside me. And I was like yelling at him. I'm like, hurry up. You know, like, I have to get to a meeting. And he's like, no, mom. And then I'm like charging ahead. And then he's like, no, mom, wait. And I turn around and I see he had his face buried in a bush of white roses. And before I could stop myself, I'm like, we don't have time to stop and smell the roses. And when I heard those words come out of my mouth, I was like, holy cow. You know, as a time and happiness expert, I'm literally yelling at my son that we don't have time to stop and smell the roses on this beautiful, perfect day. Because I was stressed out in my head, planning for what's next, thinking about what's next, anxious, thinking of all I had to do that day with so few hours to get it all done before I picked him up. And that just goes to show that there are these sort of opportunities for joy in our days. It's just we need to pay attention. Like, I actually, me pausing for all of 3 seconds to admire the roses, like, I did have 3 seconds. And actually, on that walk, if I weren't in my head, I could be walking at the same speed, but actually enjoying it and being mentally present with my son.
And presumably, you know, you've walked past those roses so many times that you're just not even seeing them anymore. And this is what you're saying, just stop, look around, and you might be amazed at what you have, kind of what's available to you, rather than seeking constantly new things that are, you know, not necessarily attainable, but are meaning that you stop and, I don't know, making the most of the precious stuff that you've already built, right?
Absolutely. It's like right there, already there, available to you, using your words, which is perfect. And you're already spending the time. So it doesn't require more time, because that's the thing that is so daunting, is that we don't feel like we have enough time to do everything that we want to and need to do. And absolutely, like, given our unrealistic lists of all that we want to and think we can and should be doing at any moment, and that gets exacerbated by our, you know, phones, where at any moment we can see through social media all the amazing things that folks are doing at that moment. But also, we can be doing a whole lot of stuff at every single moment through our phones. We can be ordering groceries. We can be learning Spanish. We can be, you know, attending a talk that will inspire us and educate us. Of course, we don't have all the hours to do all of those things available to us. But in the time that we do have, and in the time that we're already spending, there's a lot of joy that's available. We just have to pay attention to not be distracted, both by ourselves, you know, like what's going on in our minds and our to-do lists and our planning, but also, I mean, putting the phone away physically.
This is an advertisement from BetterHelp Therapy Online.
Okay, serious question. How many times have you been out recently? Actually, you know, scratch that. How many times have you woken up the day you were supposed to go out and felt flooded with dread? How long have you spent praying that the other person will cancel so you don't have to?
And yet, just as we're avoiding people, so many of us feel really lonely and more tired than ever, particularly now the days are getting a bit longer and you think, how am I going to have the energy to go out into the world?
Our social batteries are very flat at the moment, and that can make us feel isolated, which can lead to trouble. And in my experience, therapy has helped me track my best energy sources and helped me better identify what leaves me feeling depleted.
So if you're thinking of starting therapy, why not give BetterHelp a try?
It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist and switch anytime for no additional charge.
With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise.
Listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/midult. That's better, HELP.com/midult.
BetterHelp. Because sometimes the best thing to do is acknowledge that we are not, in fact, absolutely fine.
There's studies that show that the mere presence, they had this experiment where they had friends dining together, and they instructed some of the folks to put their phones away, out of sight, totally away, whereas the others could have the phone on the table. And what they found was that the folks who had the phone away, out of sight, enjoyed their dining experience more because they were more engaged. And sort of put the other way, those who simply having their phones present, it's not like they were on their phones even, just having their phones present made them enjoy their dining experience less because they were more distracted. They were thinking about all they could be doing and maybe should be doing through that phone, as opposed to like paying attention to the people right there in front of them.
What I also really love about your book is that there are so many examples. Like in the introduction, I'd written empirical research, and Adam, I was like, what is empirical research? We were talking about it, but there are so many like tiny examples. Like I love the one about the joy that people get when they give time. So you ask people to stay back after a class for an extra 15 minutes and help some junior students with their essays, or you say to the other people, hey, you've got a bonus 15 minutes free, you can leave the lesson. And the people who stayed and did the extra 15 minutes felt better about everything than the people who'd had the bonus free time. And I think that, I suppose, because we're so time, we feel so time starved, and because we are so time poor, and because we are so kind of concerned about, I guess, the idea that we're not doing enough always, and that somehow that we don't realize that actually the tiniest gains, that's the thing, isn't it, can actually translate to a big change.
Yeah. And that sort of feeling of being time poor, time starved, or not having enough time is what motivated my research, because it was what I was grappling with and really motivated the book. And I, Happier Hour, it came out in the US in September. And there's so much thirst for this. It's done really well because people are really trying to figure out, oh my gosh, I have too little time. And how do I combat this feeling? And how do I spend the hours of my days so that I don't feel so limited? Because when we feel, to the empirical research, sorry, Annabelle, the research shows that when we feel time poor, it has really negative effects. So it makes us less healthy. So like not going to the doctor, me as an example there, it makes us less likely to exercise. It makes us less confident in being able to achieve what we set out to do. It makes us less happy, and it makes us less nice. So Emily, that study that you talked about, when we feel like we don't have a lot of time, what we tend to do is not spend time to help others out. We tend to sort of continue in our rush state, taking care of ourselves, sort of hoarding this resource of time that we have so little of. But in those studies, what we found was actually when you spend time on something that increases your sense of self-efficacy. So it makes you feel like, oh my gosh, I have accomplished a lot with just a little time. And that's like, oh, I can accomplish way more than I thought with the time that I have. And it lessens that sense of limitation and increases a sense of time affluence. And so with giving time to help another out, spending time for others actually makes us feel like, wow, I can do a lot. Like it, that helping someone increases your sense of self-efficacy, and from that increases a sense of time affluence, lessening that sense of limitation. Another way of spending that it can increase self-efficacy is exercise, which is another thing that when we feel like we don't have time that we tend to neglect. It's like, I don't have time to go for a run, you know, right? Or I don't have time to go to the gym. But if you actually do, and there's research that shows that even exercise has a direct effect on our mood, but it also makes us feel better about ourselves. It makes us feel that we have accomplished and we can accomplish more. And with that, it makes us feel less time poor.
And you're not talking about, for example, helping someone. You're not talking about, and now you must volunteer for 5 hours. You're talking about, it could be a random act of kindness. It could be a 90-second less situation, aren't you, to just engage? Because sometimes time feels like the enemy, not because there isn't enough of it, but because it sort of has a grip on us in a really strange, nefarious way. I mean, I sometimes feel like my life is running me.
Totally.
You know, and I've lost track of what those pockets are. So an exercise that was interesting to me in your book is this idea of a time tracking exercise, which also terrified me, because you're saying, okay, so break your day into half hour chunks right the way through. Write everything that you do and how it made you feel. And for me, that's a bit like being scared to look at your bank balance.
Totally.
Because, you know, you don't quite know what's... I'm quite scared to look at how much time I waste. And I don't mean waste doing something frivolous that might give me joy. I mean waste as in it just goes, because I'm in a state of such panic. It runs through my fingers as I stare at the wall or stare at a screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that something that you hear about?
Yeah, absolutely. It's that sense of panic. And that's actually why there's that sort of mental hurdle to get over to take control of our time, because it does feel like it's so out of our control. And that's really what I'm hoping to help people do, is to really sort of make it feel like you have control over it. Like, talk about something that can undermine our sense of satisfaction and happiness. It is feeling out of control.
Yes, because I don't think that I'm too busy. I think I'm appropriately busy, but I am not connecting with time in the right way, so I feel deranged. And that's unnecessary, though, isn't it?
It is, because the time tracking exercise, so as you mentioned, it is over the course of a week, writing down for each 30-minute increment what you're doing, but in addition, rating on a 10-point scale, how did doing that make you feel? And while I will admit it is a sort of tedious exercise, and even some of my students have been like, this is tedious, but those same students are like, oh my gosh, afterwards it was so impactful, because the information is itself giving you control. It is like, it's something that is like, until you actually have it clearly in front of you, it seems scary and nebulous, and that it like you can't get a hold on it. But simply writing it down allows you to see, okay, how are you spending your time? And then even more helpfully, looking across your week, what are those activities that actually do bring you a great deal of satisfaction? And sometimes they're not what you predict, as well as what are those activities that like pop up and you're like, holy cow, I do not feel great coming out of those activities. And that's surprising, because I thought I liked doing X. I thought I liked socializing, but then you realize like, oh, actually in this form of like one-on-ones with these people, I feel super great, but this group of people, no. And so there's a lot of information there. And then with that information, it's really the secret is becoming just more intentional. Again, like all of the advice that I'm giving in the book is not like changing your life in crazy dramatic ways. It's about being intentional of whether it's spending your time, more time in ways that do give you satisfaction, minimizing the amount of time you spend on ways that are unnecessary and don't bring you joy, but also paying attention during those times. So it's about intentionality, both how you spend your time as well as while you're spending that time.
It's very powerful for me to hear you use the word intentionality, because that is what I lose. Because when you're in the slipstream, then you don't have any intention, and you don't have any attention, really,
right,
to pay to what you're doing at any minute of a specific day. You just sort of end up there, like really, really boring time travel. You say, oh, here I am doing this other thing that makes me feel insane that I don't enjoy. And how did I end up here? You know, in the microcosms of your day. So it's interesting, the idea of intention. And I see how this terrifying time tracking diary thing, tedious and terrifying time tracking diary thing, could help with that. You identify, don't you, there's a sort of sweet spot in terms of time that we could claw back for ourselves, which is that I think less than 2 hours leads to potentially unhappiness a day, and more than 5 hours potentially is not going to make you feel great either. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and that research, I think, so in that moment where I'm like, I don't think I can do it, and I was like, I think I should quit. The question is, if I like move to a sunny, slow place island, which is actually what I had in my head, I will just move and like live on vacation for the rest of my life, then surely I would be happier.
Because I say to you this morning, Emily, yes. I just want a country cottage. That was as far as I got. I don't want a country cottage. I'd go almost immediately insane in a country cottage. But I so relate to your island dream.
Yeah, and my...
No, but it's the same... It's the same as your blank space at the beginning... Your blank page at the beginning of the year. It's like this blank...
Make it all go away.
Terrifying. And also simultaneously how exciting to be able to fill it with all these things. And then you think about what you might fill it with, and then that's terrifying.
Totally.
Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, no, but it's exactly that. Like, we have this sort of daydream that if only I had all of the hours of my day to spend exactly how I wanted, then surely I would be happier. But we looked at what's the relationship between the amount of discretionary time people have and their happiness. And what we found across our studies, we looked at tens of thousands of individuals. What we found is that an inverted U shape, so like an arc, meaning that on both ends of the spectrum, too little time and too much time, people are unhappy. And the too little time is the time poor, time stressed. And that's understandable because that's higher levels of stress. And in that data set, we found it was less than approximately 2 hours of discretionary time in the day. But I think the more interesting part is that other end of the spectrum, that with, in that data set, more than approximately 5 hours of discretionary time in the day, people are also less happy. I wouldn't hang my hat on the specific amount of time, but it's just pointing out, and the data supports, that there is such thing as having too much time. And the reason for that is because we want to be somewhat productive, or even if it's not productive, we want to spend some hours of the day feeling like we have something to show for it. And when we don't, then it actually undermines our sense of purpose. And with that, we feel less satisfied. So Annabelle, in your cottage, I'm sure like the first week would actually be blissful. But then the next week you're like, oh my God, what am I gonna do? Like, what am I gonna do that makes me feel fulfilled? And we do find that actually the too much time effect doesn't happen when people are spending their discretionary time in ways that feel quote unquote worthwhile. So worthwhile to them, whether that is a hobby that is like really enriching and allows you to sort of develop and build, exercise, also social connection. You see that there isn't such thing as too much social connection. Now, I want to be clear, it's not like going out to, you know, like cocktail parties every night necessarily. It's really...
Thank God.
Sounds exhausting. It is engaging in relationships and having those conversations that feel connecting in whatever sort of way that is for you. So it's not that available time is bad, but it is, Annabelle, to your point, it's like, okay, with my available time, how do I spend it so that at least some of the hours of my day are spent in ways that feel worthwhile? And then there, like, it doesn't have to be all, right? Because there's that sort of portion in the middle where there's a positive role for relaxation, you know, watching TV. But actually interesting in the time tracking research and the studies, like when my students do it too, is that TV is fun for like that first bit, but when you're like on hour 5 of binging, it's actually less enjoyable because of what I said before about hedonic adaptation, right? So at the beginning, it's like that idea of like at the end of the day with your glass of wine, turning on Netflix, that is bliss for the first like half hour, 45 minutes, hour maybe even. But like hour 3, then you're just like aggravated, you know, like, and you're like, I shouldn't be here. I'm tired, I need to go to bed. Someone like, you know, texts you and you're like, ugh, they're annoying me. Like, it's just like, it's like an unhappy state. But that first half hour, so it's, again, intentionality of like, where do you spend so that you get the most out of the time that you're spending? And that's the point.
One of the really good examples of how you define what is useful time is the time jar. Can you talk us through that? Because that's so I think that's so helpful in the idea that you can fill it so easily with, well, you tell us exactly
what
you
want. And it will be filled, whether you fill represents. It or not.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and this is a really helpful analogy that I continue to touch back to when making my own time spending decisions. And it's actually nicely shown in a short film that I share in my first day of class. And in the film, a professor walks into his classroom, and on the desk at the front of the room, he puts a large clear jar. And then from a bag on the side into the jar, he pours golf balls such that the golf balls reach the very top of the jar. And he asks the students, is the jar full? And the students nod their head because, yes, the jar looks full. And he's like, nope. From the bag, he pulls out a bunch of pebbles and he pours the pebbles into the jar, and the pebbles fill the spaces around the golf balls up to the very top. And he asks the students, is the jar full? And the students are like, yes, the jar looks full. It's like, nope. From the bag, he pulls out sand and he pours the sand into the jar, and the sand fills all of those spaces between the golf balls, between the pebbles up to the very top. And he asks the students, is the jar full? Full. And by this point, the students are like laughing. They're like, yes, the jar is full. But there was one more step. From the bag, he pulled out two bottles of beer. He opened one, poured it into the jar, and then he opened the other. And he sort of goes in to the front of the desk and perches himself, takes a sip, and he explains, this jar is the time of your life. Those golf balls are all those things that really matter to you. Your family members, your friendships, that work that you do that you really love and are passionate about and sort of aligned with your purpose. The pebbles are all those other important things in your life, like your job, your house. The sand, though, the sand is everything else. The sand is all of that stuff that will fill your time. And what's really important to note is, had he poured the sand into the jar first, all of the golf balls would not have fit. And so if you let your time get filled mindlessly, unintentionally, you know, to your point, Annabelle, it will get filled. It's just, it will make it so that you don't have time for that stuff that really matters to you. And so the important thing is we do need to become proactive, intentional, as opposed to reactive and just like life happening to us, which is scary and stressful and anxiety producing, is identify your golf balls. What are those things that really matter to you? And put them into the jar first. Like, schedule them, make time for them. And then the sand, like everything, the sand will come in. It will fill everything else. But as long as you have made time for and spent time for and been engaged during that time for those things that really matter, then it's fine if you're busy, right? Like, fine to be busy as long as you have spent and invested in those things that really matter to you. And so those golf balls can, like, that's also a big part of the book, is to help you identify what are your golf balls. What are those things that really matter to you? What are those sources of joy, those sources of connection, those sources of fulfillment? And it can be a really simple, mundane, ordinary thing. Like, I share the example of my weekly coffee date with my daughter. This is so ordinary. And it, like, is born out of a very functional routine of me wanting to get coffee on the way to drop her off at her preschool. But we turned what was routine into a ritual. We made it special. We've given it a name. And we started when she was 3. Now she's 7. And we do it every week. And it's just a half hour. It's not a lot of time. But it's really special time that we look forward to. So, like, even beyond the time that we're spending during it, it's like there's the anticipation. And then there's the remembering and talking about. And so those 30 minutes have a really profound impact on my satisfaction in life, even, because I'm like, when you ask me, like, how happy are you or how satisfied? I'm like, I am really satisfied. And that was, what am I sort of pulling to my mind? It's like, oh, I have a really lovely relationship with my daughter. And, you know, like, I really do love the work that I do because I've like carved out time to actually do the work that I love. Whereas, you know, the sand, responding to email, showing up to meetings, that could ultimately have filled the last 15 years of my career. But I would have been really intentional to like make sure that I protect time for the work that really matters, like writing this book, so that it, like, I feel a sense of progress and fulfillment.
You said the word purpose earlier, which I'm not going to take as an act of aggression. I'm going to say, yes, we're all very interested in that. And there's some stuff in your book around how to get to the bottom of the why.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think, you know, you're busy, you're tired, and you spend a lot of time, if you do stop to think, what you're sort of thinking is, what's the point?
Yeah. And honestly, the pandemic has led all of us to think, what's the point? It has been a very existential experience for everyone. I mean, whether you personally lost someone, it just made us all realize that life is fragile. And that's why time is so important, because the hours of our days sum up to the years of our life. And when we recognize just how fragile and finite life is, it makes us realize how important those hours are. And that leads us to think about, what's the point?
No, I couldn't actually bear to, that you have a whole chapter on, and we talked about it a little bit before, about, you know, the how much time you have left to do things. And it's almost like if you read a book a week and you're going to live another four, it is literally that, isn't it? And you're going to live another 40 years. Therefore, there are only so many more books you're going to read. And once you realize that, every book you read is precious. Yeah. And you know, but then you'd start doing that with, if you only have dinner with somebody you love twice a year, and you're only going to, that's only that many dinners. And I actually got quite, it's interesting, I got quite panicky thinking about it. And I think that, I got a bit scared. It was scary. It's scary to think that you, and it does put the pressure on the purpose, which I think is a good thing. But, you know, and I think obviously I have to like react to that fear and then start thinking about how I can, you know, respond to it in a positive way. But it is, you know, we can no longer hide from that.
Well, I think,
do you know what I mean?
That there isn't that tipping point for that. It's like, okay, yeah. So here comes the next bit. Mm-hmm. Which is why your why exercises, I think, are quite, because you could apply this. You say, why is that important? Why do I care about that? And so on and so forth. But that that doesn't have to be about your career, does it?
No.
It can be, again, about small decisions that you make. And I'm starting to think, having read your book, that, you know, then the big decisions will come rather than the other way around.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the five whys exercise is an exercise to help you identify what is your purpose. And the purpose being, like, it's such a loaded word that you, like, you know, you sort of like, ugh, roll your eyes. But what it is basically like, what motivates you? What are those goals? Like that sort of higher order goal. Like, what do you ultimately care about of like doing? And it's basically, so to answer, like, it doesn't have to be about like, it doesn't have to start with your work of like, what do you do for work? It would be like, what do you do? And why do you do that? And then your answer to why you do that, ask again, well, why does that matter to me? And when you ask sort of five layers of why as to why you do what you do, then you really sort of uncover and identify like what motivates you, like what really does matter to you. And what's helpful about this is that it allows you to be it's a personal thing. It's not like these are general notions of success, which my MBA students like really struggle with, like what is success, and like it's tied to like money or procedure, these things that are constantly changing, and someone else like it like shows up differently for other people. So you always feel like you're lacking, right? But when you identify like what really motivates you, then that's all that matters. It's like, why do you do that? And then you can use that as a filter for like, do you say yes to that invitation. It's like, or do you say yes to that project? Or, you know, do you say yes to spending your hour in that particular way? The five whys is interesting. And actually, like, I'm sure, Emily, if you didn't like the counting times left, maybe the eulogy exercise was even more like
terrifying. Actually chilling.
Terrifying.
I wasn't even going to mention the eulogy exercise.
Also, they were so beautiful, the eulogies. And I thought, oh my God, I haven't even looked at my life this way. And it was, yes, okay. Anyway, sorry, Cassie.
Yeah. I mean, yes, yet another horrifying exercise, which my purpose is not to make everyone sort of profoundly scared of their death. It is to help people gain some clarity onto, like, what life do you want to live? And with that, sort of thinking about, like, what matters, like taking a step back from the sort of onslaught of day-to-day requests and, you know, the sense of urgency in the hour. It's like, take a step back, think about your life as a whole. And we actually find in our research that when people think about their time more broadly, thinking in terms of years in their life overall instead of hour by hour, they are actually report greater feelings of meaning, satisfaction, and even happiness in their days because they have more sort of clarity on like what matters, like almost like what are those golf balls? And with that, using that as a filter of like, and a guide to how do I spend my hours? So thinking about your life overall helps inform how do you spend your hours? You know, what do you say yes to? What do you say no to? What activities do you pursue? So Annabelle, like, it's a really exciting opportunity, this sort of new year that seems like a blank slate of like, okay, what matters to you? Like, what do you want to spend your time on? Like, and that's
yes,
exciting.
And trying to create some intention before all that sand rushes in,
right.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've got ideas. I might have to go because I might have to go and put things into my diary. I'm just thinking I must put in gallery for a Friday afternoon rather than just, you know, stare at the wall.
Fantastic. I'm so excited.
So if you've
you.
Left me with that, then you've left me with something. Cassie, thank you so much for coming to talk to us. And Cassie's book, Happier Hour, How to Spend Your Time for a Better, More Meaningful Life, is out now. Thank you so much. And I think it's a really, really useful, really optimistic read to take you into 2023.
Yeah, I completely agree, apart from the fact that I was terrified of one bit of it. But generally, I mean, the fact that you say really early on, you say having loads of money, being gorgeous, or all of those things sound like they're secrets to living happily, but they're not. And I think that's the real key to remember exactly that. It's about what makes you feel, I don't know, present, connected, engaged with, you know, the people you love. And that's how wonderful for it's that we can aspire to rather than
and that. Wearing and sparkly fancy cowboy boots in the kitchen, even
yes.
if you're trying to break them in. Just the thought of you wearing those boots like on a, you know, random evening cooking dinner, it's fantastic. I love it.
She's gonna go and put them on now, I can tell. Look at this, that
yeah.
naughty
Look
twinkle
at
in her eyes. Cassie Holmes, you've been amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Annabelle Rifkin and Emily McMeekin of The Middot. Our book, I'm Absolutely Fine, is out now. If you like what you hear, please rate, review and subscribe.